help me give him a warm welcome.
You got it? Okay, cool.
Get it, Glennie.
Hello, everyone. I'm Glenn. I'm an alcoholic. And there's no place to put my water. So, here we are. It's time to get honest, huh? Woo, you can do that for a couple of minutes sitting in a sheet, you know, just sharing. It's all good. Give your little thing and then you're done. But 40 minutes is what I'm going to try to attempt to be done tonight. I think that won't be a problem because I'm not good for going over. So we'll get everybody out here on time. I want to thank Stan and Glenn asking me to come up here tonight and share my experience, strength, and hope with you guys. And I want to welcome the new people and folks that have been around and back here again one more time. I want to welcome you. I want to thank you for being here tonight, all of you. I know so many familiar faces here tonight. I think everybody I pretty much know here. So that still hasn't taken away the anxiety of being up here and telling my story. That's for sure. So, I guess the hardest part for me is the realization to know that I can't drink again. That would be probably the biggest, significant, most impact in my life. Because I had tried so many years to prove that I can control and enjoy my drinking over and over and over and over. It's that first step, that step before the first step, that innermost self thing. I never really wanted to admit to that. I had tried so many relationships, which I'll share with you tonight, institutions, which I'll share with you tonight. I will attempt to keep it as real and as non-graphic as possible, but that's my story. It's graphic, you know, it's not pretty. My story's not pretty, you know. I didn't learn. I didn't come in here the first time and just get it. You know, it wasn't something that I walked into and I went, wow, this is a room full of people I identify with. Now, my intention was good. It was really good. I got in here and many, many years ago, and I'm not proud to admit that. 1987, 88 was my first 12-step program. And it was a member of Cocaine Anonymous. It's how I learned to become that I was an alcoholic. And I got to tell you, those guys loved me that I couldn't love myself. I would walk in sucked up, messed up. I had blisters on my lips. I couldn't stop using, and they would hug me and love me and say, you don't have to live this way. I was all of about 28 years old, and I couldn't stop using. And I had just thrown alcohol away because in my earlier years of my drinking, it was all about just drinking on the weekends. I wasn't a big alcoholic. I didn't think I was really an alcoholic. I didn't think I suffered from this disease that centered in my mind, in my body and soul, you know. And I didn't think about it, you know. I just thought I had a drug problem. The meetings I was going to, they all identified as alcoholics and drug addicts. It was a co-addictive thing. And that's how I got into this deal. And they were talking the language of the heart. They were working the 12 steps. They were working those 12 steps out of the Alcoholics Anonymous big book. They would work the program that way. And they would tell me, like, these are the steps. You know, this is our format. And I would read them because I'm from the streets and I know better than everybody else. I would read them. I got that. That's easy. Why? What do you mean live them? I don't understand. I couldn't comprehend living sober. I couldn't comprehend being honest with myself. I couldn't comprehend friends, intimacy, you know, all the things that life would throw your way in some sort of normality order. I couldn't comprehend them. See, what happened with me was when I was growing up as a kid, my parents weren't together. So they were divorced at a very early age. I was the youngest of me and my sister. And our home was just pretty much fit for yourself. Clothes I wore up until probably sixth grade, my mom probably bought for me, but after that I cooked for myself. I always had a job, always had to take care of myself, always had to hustle up the next few dollars and coins to be able to survive. See, I was a survivor and I didn't even know it. I was just surviving. I had no application to live. Zero. My dad was a rageaholic, I like to call him, because he went from zero to hero in about 2 seconds. And when I would go visit him, he would remind me what a loser I was, and he would beat me. And I don't share these things because I want you to feel sorry for me. This is my story. It may not be your story, but my story is not pretty. There was sexual abuse in the home, and I was a part of that. You know, there was physical abuse on both sides. I was a part of that. Loneliness, I wanted to escape from it as a kid. And I didn't know any about, you know, I didn't know anything of these natures. You know, you're just a kid living and moving along and hustling, and I learned how to live in the streets, and I didn't know anything about any of these things that I'm telling you until I got here. Late in my 20s, I started to hear the message. Even though I couldn't comprehend the message, I started to hear it. I started to hear how other people were having issues. Other people were having problems. And I identified, but I just wasn't ready to stop using and drinking. I just wasn't. I just couldn't get it. And as I grew up as a child, I grew up in Guadalupe. Okay? So the first 12 years of my life, I'm a Caucasian kid in Guadalupe with an afro. So I got to tell you, if you didn't stick out like a sore thumb, I did, you know? And my nationality runs probably about 3 parts Indian, Spanish, English, Irish, German, Scottish, and Dutch, and a little bit of black. And I got to tell you, I've tried to live up to every single one of those things. You know? I have. I really have. They'd ask me, man, what nationality are you in school? They'd ask me, what nationality are you? I didn't know. I didn't know what nationality I was until later on in my 20s when I got in front of my grandmother and she told me. She told me what I was, and I had no clue. Growing up in a dysfunctional family was not a blessing at all. It was a curse. It really was, because I had no guidelines. There were no boundaries for a kid like me. I could do whatever I wanted. And I took that to full force. I really did, you know. I remember as an early age, I always had to defend my right for who I was. I always had to do it. I always had to stick up for who I thought I was. And most of the time, it wasn't pretty. We're always fist fighting at school. I don't think I ever went to high school once. I think I showed up like in my 9th grade or something like that. And they were like, "You're here." Yeah, F's, straight across the board, straight F's. Straight F's, I'd never went to school. They just passed me because they didn't know what to do with me. And in that years, you're talking like early 70s, they didn't know, they just kept putting you in these remedial programs. Here, go to this program, learn how to read and write. You know, they didn't know that you had alcoholism. They didn't understand family disease. They didn't know what dysfunction was. They didn't know. So they would just put you in a place that they thought that was best for you. And I never fit in, ever. I was always different. I tried to, even though that I hung out with people that smoked weed and we drank and all that, I always still felt different. Like I just couldn't belong anywhere. And it was all because of what was going on in my life up until that point. I was a member of the Klein Bottle. I don't know if you guys know what that was. So back then it was a place for guys like me who were not connected in society at all, that had to have a place to go to be able to have counseling. And that was kind of like, in my early years, it was already starting. Program, discussing your feelings, because we didn't talk about those things. People were beating on me, man. They didn't ask me, why didn't you go to school? They beat me because I didn't do right in school. No one got down to causes and conditions like we do here. We get down to causes and conditions here by working the steps. That's what happens. We uncover, discover, discard. And when you're young like that and you're very impressionable, you follow the wrong crowd. You just do. No excuses. It's just the way it was. I can't change the past, you know, and talking about it's not easy. You know, I remember sometime around probably just after junior high school, I decided that running away was going to be a good idea. Didn't like the family life, didn't have much structure there. So I lived in the streets for a couple of years. You know, I hitchhiked around. I had an older friend. He was like 16, 17 years old. He taught me how to panhandle. He taught me how to beg for money. You know, we had all kinds of stories for adults, you know, to get cash. And that's how we lived. We drank Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill and TJ Swan. And you know, we were hustlers, man. We used to steal, I'm not telling you, we used to steal March of Dimes cans and go and out in the community and get money. And we would just go up to anybody. We had balls of steel. Balls of steel, man. Hey, can you help us out? We're with St. Mary's, you know? And we had lines for everything. It's no wonder I'm a car salesman, right? Yeah. It is what it is, you know. They were already molding me at that point, you know. And early on in my childhood, they were molding me to do the things that I could build a career out of. But, you know, I didn't know. I really didn't know until I got here how dysfunctional my life really was. And as I was living in the streets, running around and panhandling and getting dough and buying weed, you know, at an early age, something happened around my early in my sophomore year where I thought, well, maybe calling my dad would be a good idea. You know, he hadn't been in the picture for a long time. I thought maybe a father image would work for me, you know, in my life. And I called him from the payphone, and he's like, I haven't talked to him in several years. He was living in Orange County at the time. And this is a guy that had been in and out of my life from day one. I never knew him. We never spent time together. We never went fishing. We never hung out like me and my son. I'll get into that later. It was just, you know, a cry for help is what it was. And so he asked me where I was, and I said, well, I'm living in Santa Barbara. He says, well, where are you living at? On the beach. Yeah, you know, and so he came down, he picked me up, and he took me up to Orange County, and he put me in this regular high school. Now, up until then, I never really done much with school. You know, there was no way that I had any academic skills. I couldn't read. I couldn't really write. Most of my stuff was just clowning around and passing classes on the fly. And in Santa Maria at that time, they just kind of moved you along. They didn't pay much attention, you know. That's just how it was, you know. They put me in regular school, and I did not. I had no business being in that high school. Zero. You know, people were getting good grades. There were academic scholarships going on back and forth. I'm at a Estancia High School in Costa Mesa. I'm living in a wealthy area, and I am not even close to what these people are about. Not even in the same area code. You know, I'm a street guy. I hustle. That's what I do. I size you up. I read you. I get your money. Then I leave. You know, what am I doing there? That's how it was. So as I got into school down there, went to some parties, got to hang out with some of the in crowd. You know, they thought I was cool because I had these long ass afro, and you know, I could talk the game and all that. But deep down, I was scared to death. You know, I couldn't fit in. I wasn't anywhere near these people, and I was smoking weed all the time and drinking. And you know, weed was something that was a daily deal for me. There wasn't a time from probably 13 years old up until the time I joined the United States Marine Corps that I didn't get high. Daily. All day. I think I just stayed numb. And growing up in my dad's house, it was very physical because I was afraid to tell him that I couldn't do well in school. He had these measures for me. I was quite the athlete, believe it or not. I could play ball. I could play football, basketball, baseball. I was, you know, I was quite the athlete. And he always wanted me to go out for these teams, and I would make the team, but my grades would fall short, and I just couldn't measure up. And he would beat me, and beat me, and beat me. And I ran away from him. I took off, came back home to mom, because mom let me do whatever I wanted to, man. I could get high in the bathroom. I could, you know, hang out, have my friends over. We drink margaritas. She was Mrs. Lucy Goosey. She stayed out till way late in the hours, and I'd have parties. When the time came, when I was 17 years old, at this point. I went to my mom and I was hanging out with a friend of mine, and he had a great idea to join the United States Marine Corps. He had a really good idea. He said, man, we got this buddy program, we should go. I'm like, dude, there's no way I can pass a written exam. Physically, no problem, but mentally, forget it, it's not gonna happen. And he says, nah, man, I'm telling you, just come meet this recruiter, he's gonna give us the answers to the test, you know? And there's just another break for old Glenn right there, you know? Nobody could just say, dude, you don't have it together, let's help you, you know? You're way over your head at this point, you know? You're going in the Marine Corps at 17, you don't have any academic skills, you've been beat on, you've been molested, you're a time bomb. You're a walking time bomb. I had no business joining the service. How am I gonna defend our country or help defend the country? I'm a mess. So I go take this test and almost failed that son of a bitch. They gave me the answers and I almost failed it, but I passed. It was a saving grace. The grace of God came over me, gave me a shot to make it right. And I went in boot camp and I survived. I think we started out with about 70 some people. We ended up graduating 37. And I was one of the lucky 37 that graduated. Because I had enough gut and grit in me, enough street smarts to know that I couldn't go back and doing what I was doing. It was either jail or it was this. So I chose this. And I fucked that up. Yeah, it wasn't like I joined and I grew up all of a sudden, right? I joined and things got worse. They got out of hand because I'm immature. I passed the physical part, I take the academic skills test, I know how to fire weapons, blow up stuff, first aid. I learned all these things that I didn't think that I could do. It gave me some courage. About a year in, I decided to go AWOL because I'm a runner. That's what I do, I run away. But they held me accountable for my actions. They did that, you know. And at that time, you know, I'm suffering from alcoholism, untreated alcoholism. I don't even know I have alcoholism. You know, I have no clue that something is going on bigger than me. Zero. So at that particular time, I take off, fly 3,000 miles away because, you know, we just run. No one's going to find me. So I go to this... my first hostage. I end up in Arkansas with a girl that I went to high school with over there for a short time, and we ended up hanging out, and I ended up staying there. And their parents got wind that I was AWOL, so they call the service. They come and get me and send me back home. So I end up having to stand tall and serve some time in the brig. And when I got out, they gave me a choice. You can either fly right or go home. We don't want you. I said, I'm flying right, and I did. And it was the best thing I ever did because it taught me something about sticking it out. It taught me something about believing in myself. All the things that I had learned something because up until then, I learned nothing, right? It doesn't matter how much I know. It matters how much I really take along with the experiences, you know, along the way. And I completed and I got an honorable discharge. I got out when I was 21 years old. I was able to reap the rewards of the benefits that I have today by owning a home and things like that, you know, because I stuck it out. And when I got out, I moved back into Santa Maria, and the party was on. You know, it was on. And we drank all the time, we used all the time. We were up late, I got a job as a waiter, and I ended up working at this really fine dining restaurant. And there I learned how to cater to people. I learned how to use some of my skills that I learned up until then, how to read people, make them happy, that kind of thing, you know. And I was making some pretty good money, and I moved up to captain in the dining room, and I was learning how to be etiquette. You know, I learned about etiquette. I learned about class. I learned about style. I learned how to be a persona person, how to be a showman and all that, you know. And it gave me a lot of courage. So I got an idea. I had a great idea. I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take this act, and I'm moving to LA, and I'm going to become an actor. That's what I'm going to do. With $285 in my pocket, I leave my apartment in Santa Maria to another guy, and I move to LA. And I get down there, and I'm scared to death, but I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this because I believe in myself, and this is my passion. This is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to do this. And I get down there, and it wasn't about probably 6 months down there. I ended up, I think the writers went on strike. There was a huge, you couldn't get any work anywhere. So I ended up waiting tables again, got into sales, and I ended up slipping into an alleyway and got hooked on crack cocaine. And everything that I wanted in my life slipped out of my life like that. It took me down so fast. And right now, in retrospect, I'm grateful for that drug because it took me down so fast. Alcohol killed me slowly, but that drug took me down fast. And I haven't used that drug in over 30 years, but it took me down fast. And it gave me a way in to this 12-step program that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got more one-year chips than I can tell you. I'm serious. I can't tell you how many one-year chips I have. It's horrible. You know, my first meeting was about 1987, 1988, somewhere in there. And I got 30 days I'd go out. I'd get 60 days I'd go out. I'd share from these chairs like I knew what the hell I was talking about, and I'd go out. You saw some of that when I came in here last time, you know. And my inability to be honest with you and with others, I had always had a wall. I could sound good. I could do the things that you wanted me to do on the outside, but inside I'd leave. I wouldn't do anything, and I just, you know, I'd be scared to death to try anything new. I got married the first time around 1988 because I really thought the girl I was going to marry was going to save me from my addiction. She was normal. She was in the police academy. She was Cuban. She was hot, and she was gonna fix me. She was gonna that was the one for me. Wasn't a year later I had trashed that marriage because of my nights out and the endeavors that I endured. You know, didn't last. Had a child from that. He's 28 today. I haven't talked to him in about 10 years, and I'll get into that here in a little bit. But in no time, we ended up getting a divorce. And it's all centered around the disease of alcoholism. It just is. All these things that I'm telling you about is all part of the disease. You know? The chance to make it right will come up in that marriage. It will. I know it's going to have to. I'm going to have to pick up the 100-pound phone at some point and make some amends, you know? Not wanting to do that, but I know it's what I need to do. Because Joel, my sponsor, always tells me we do the things that we don't want to do to stay here. And up until now, everything that I haven't wanted to do has worked out. So, you know. So through that marriage, we divorced 2 years after that. I'm still going in and out of CA Anonymous and drinking here, drinking there. And somewhere around 1992, I finally got a taste of this thing. I really started to get a grasp of what was going on in Los Angeles. And I started working these 12 steps. I got a sponsor. I got a couple of years of sobriety. And the earthquake happened in 94. It demolished our entire home from ceiling to toe. And we were able to get out of there alive. And I ended up moving a different wife at that time. I had gotten married again because she was going to fix me. And step one, people, places, circumstances, and situations don't fix guys like me or probably women like you, you know. I'm sure of it. I'm convinced of it now. And so I go ahead and I take on that new marriage, and she gets pregnant right away, which our current son now is 23. We get married, and after that, really quick, we move up to Santa Maria, and I'm coming from the, I don't know, somewhere around Studio City area, where you walk into a meeting, there's non-smoking meetings, you know, everybody's there is in a whole different world, you know, and I walk into the 1600 Club, and it's filled with smoke. It's just like from head to toe smoke. They got a no-smoking section, but it's not a no-smoking section. It is far from a no-smoking section. And I walk in, I said, hell no, I'm not going here. Fuck no, don't you know who I am? And I leave, and I get on the marijuana maintenance program. Fast forward 5 years after the marijuana maintenance program, I get pulled over, I get a DUI, scares the shit out of me, and I go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. So this is like in 1999, and I walk in to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm ready to do anything, because I'm ready to lose my license, lose my job. At that time, I'm working as a car salesman. I'm making pretty decent money now. I'm being able to support my family, but I got an alcohol problem, you see. I got a marijuana problem, you see. I got Glenn's in the way one more time. And so I go in, and I get a sponsor. His name's Malcolm. I don't know, you guys remember Malcolm, right? What a loving guy. I miss that guy dearly. You know, that guy loved me until I couldn't love myself, man. He put up with me. He put up with me more than anyone that I ever knew, except for the sponsor I have today. But he really did. He loved me. He was a big guy, and he would hug me. You know, we'd go outside after the meetings, and he would hug me, and he'd say, it's going to be okay, man. You're going to be all right, you know. And I had this DUI thing over my head, and we ended up beating that down to what, reckless, and I ended up keeping my license. By the grace of God, I could still work where I was working, and I started my journey one more time in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got involved. You know, I got involved. I got on fire. I started working the steps, and I did inventories, but I still had a level of honesty I couldn't get real with. There was something going on. Like, I'm going to do what you tell me to do. I'm going to go ahead and work those steps. I'm going to get a sponsor, and, you know, but deep down, there's some stuff I really need to talk about. There's some stuff in sexual inventory that I'm not uncovering, and it's going to take me out because I'm acting out on it still, see? And I remember doing my fourth step with him. Let's talk about sex. All right. So, because this is my story. This is exactly how it goes. So, I do my fourth step with Malcolm. I leave him, and I go right over to the Rhino, and I enjoy myself for the whole entire evening. Now, I got to tell you, I don't advise that for anybody. If you do a four-step and you go act out on a sexual problem, you haven't done a four-step. You probably should go back and revisit that sexual inventory and find your misconducts and list them on paper. Because we struggle with that stuff, you know. We don't talk about that. That's why I'm talking about it, you know. I'm mad enough to sit up here and tell you there are issues in my life. Right? If I don't tell you and I don't relieve those to you in a general way, I don't have to go into detail, what hope do I have to be honest enough to stay sober? I don't. It will come back. It has bitten me in the ass, and I'll get into that. Here's what happens. So, I stick around. I'm playing softball with the guys, Jim, E, Darren. We're winning tournaments. We're going. I'm involved. I'm doing all kinds of great things. I had inherited a bunch of money in 2002. It was ridiculous how much money I had inherited, and I did not know how to handle it. Zero. I tried to learn how to handle it, but it was too big for me. And prostitution came into play, and I wasn't stripping. I was buying. You know, I'm not proud of that. Gambling came into play. This is sober. I'm sober. I've got 4 or 5 years sober at the time. And I've started acting out on character defects. Big time. Now I got money. I can do whatever I want. As long as I'm sober and I don't drink anything other than a Monster, I'm going to be okay. Wrong. I'm lying. Malcolm's just like, what am I going to do with you? You know, I'm not condoning any of your behavior. You're over the top, man. You need to calm down. You need to, as my friend Cal would say, reel it in, Glennie. You need to reel it in, you know. And I didn't know anything about reeling it in. It was always on. It was either A or B, and I'm in, you know. And so I stuck around. My first 5 years, I took chips. The first 4 years, I did pretty well. My fourth, between 4 and 5, I started acting out sexually again. I started gambling. My poor wife. I just feel so bad for her at that time, you know, because she's got to live with this animal. I'm an animal. I'm not doing her right. No matter how unhappy I am in the marriage, she might have her part, but I got my part, and I can own that today. You know, that's me. But, you know, she didn't tell me to go out and do these things. I took it upon myself to do these things. Instead of getting honest and working the program and saying, hey, we need to talk. We're not intimate enough, and we need to sit down and talk about that. Instead, I just go do what I want to do. As long as I'm buying you stuff, it's cool. Take care of yourself. But I got it, you know? And around year five, I stopped coming to meetings. I don't go anymore. I just forget about it. You know, I go maybe once a month. I check in. I see people I like. Hang out a little bit, and I leave. Don't take a chip in my 6th year. Don't take a chip in my 7th year. I don't take a chip in my 8th year. I don't even come around. I'm not grateful anymore. I take it back. Forget step 3. Forget step 11. Forget all the work that I've done, all the uncovering I've done, everything that I've ever learned here. Forget about it. It's gone. Glenn's got Glenn back in the game. And as long as I don't pick up, I got a chance. I'm way out there. Insanity has returned. And the book talks about that. Insanity returns before we drink. It just does. It's my experience. It's not what I've been told. It's what I have done. You know? And so around year 8. Whew! Okay. So around year 8, this is what happens. So I'm... I'll just be honest. So we're out gambling one night in Paris, me and my brother-in-law, and we're close to Tijuana, Mexico. And I got like $3,000 in my pocket. And I tell him, I said, hey, man, you know, let's go to Tijuana, man. He goes, no, I know you, cabrón. He's Mexican, right? I know you, cabrón. We don't need to be going to Tijuana, Mexico. I know you. We're just going to gamble. No, let's go, man. Let's go have some fun. You know, so I talk him into it because I'm a good salesman. That's what I do, right? So we end up down there, and I keep them there for 3 days is what happens. And I end up going out and drinking, and there wasn't a massage parlor or anything else that was safe in that area at that time. You know, the insanity had returned big time, like it never had returned before. And I'm not proud of these things. I don't stand up here telling you these things because I think you should know me. That's the last thing I want to be talking about. But I do this because I know somebody in this room right now is struggling with these things. And you might not be struggling with any one of those things all at the same time, but you might be struggling with one of them. And I know it's important for me to get up here and tell the truth because this is my story. I can share Joe's story. I can share Daryl's story. I can share all the people that are in my life. I can share a few other stories, but this is mine. I turn to sex. I turn to drugs. I turn to alcohol, gambling, anything that doesn't allow me to grow spiritually, I turn to. That's what I do. You know, I don't tell the truth. I learn how to hide the truth. That's what I do. And I had to learn that really early on. So we go down there, the poor guy, you know, the poor bastard. He hates me, you know. We come home, he's fit to be tied. We get home, and my wife doesn't even say where you guys been. She doesn't care, you know. At this point, this is like 16 years of marriage. She's done over me anyway, you know. She's like, I can't control a guy. When he's on, he's on. He's out there, you know. And so I come back and I drink for another 7 years. I don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I try to control it. My drinking starts in slowly, just on the weekends, then just a few days a week. I'm on the marijuana maintenance program again. I'm doing what I did before I started, only it's worse this time. And what happens is, at the end of it all, I wind up feeling lonely, tired, bewildered. Nothing fixes me. There isn't an institution in Santa Barbara that fixes Glenn anymore. There isn't enough alcohol. There isn't enough weed. There isn't enough anything to fix me. And I become broken. And I end up going to a therapist. I went through 2 bouts of cancer. One in 2007 and one in 2014. So around 2000, just before October of 2015, which is my sobriety date, I go to the cancer treatment center, and he pulls a blood work on me, and he says, hey, everything looks great. You know, you're doing really good. You're beating this lymphoma. You should have been dead 5 years ago. I don't know how I'm alive. I got a really bad lymphoma. It's called mantle cell lymphoma. Look it up. Most people don't last after 5 years. I've been able to beat it for over almost 10 years now, you know, by the grace of God. And I take advantage of that, you know. I'm not in gratitude about that, but lately I've been more gratitude about that because I'm doing work behind that. And I should be grateful for my life because I should be dead. You know? And so I walk in there and he does a liver panel on me and he says, "Wow, everything was great, but your liver is friggin' out of control." I'm like, and they didn't say it like that, but I'm just telling you, that's how I heard it, you know? And he says, "Your liver, your ATLs or something like that," he says, "they should be about 35, 36. Yours are in the 500s. You're sick. What's going on?" And so I tell him, "I got an alcohol problem." And he goes, "Okay, I got a therapist. We're going to send you to her." And I'm like, "No, I don't want to do that." He goes, "No, I know. You should just go talk to her. You know, just talk to her." So I go in, I sit down with her. And when I sit down with her, I just start crying. Because I know the gig is up. I can't do it anymore. Every avenue I've tried to I've dragged this alcoholism untreated for many years now. We're you know, I'm the guy that carries the cart plus. You know, I got like 20 other pounds behind it. I got this, you know. No matter how exhausting it is, I got to prove to myself I'm not an alcoholic because I'm stubborn like that. Don't you understand? I don't need to be beaten down. I'm in control. I've had to learn that the hard way, you know. If you're sitting in this room, you have a chance. If you're having a hard time staying sober, you have a chance. Today could be the day. Today could be the day that you don't have to be a relapser anymore. It could be that day. Somebody came up to me, and the last time I was in here, when I was just starting to take this thing seriously, they says, "You know what? Your story can be no more relapse. It's okay. You can change it right now if you really want it. If you're willing to go to any length to stay sober, you can change that." I'm like, wow, maybe I could. You know, maybe if I take this thing seriously, like I have a freaking disease like cancer, you go and get treated for cancer, they give you, you know, chemotherapy, they radiate you and all kinds of stuff to help you get better, you know? So I start working the process. I'm broken inside. I'm emotionally bankrupt in every area, and I get serious about what my life has become. At that time, my wife leaves me. Kid goes to college. She says, "I'm done." As soon as he leaves, 2 weeks later, I'm out. Like, she's been waiting, you know. I can't blame her, you know. I mean, I can list all her faults, but who cares about that? It doesn't matter. We're not supposed to be together. It's bottom line, you know. And I'm cool with that today. It broke my heart that she left, but it's okay now. You know, because I get to know who I am today. I get to see the inside stuff that I'm a broken person. I'm still broken. I still got flaws, big time. And I get to work on those things, you know. And I'm not perfect. I'm not. By any stretch of means am I not perfect. But I got hope today and willingness today, no matter how far down the scale I go in Alcoholics Anonymous, as long as I don't pick up a drink, I got a chance. I got a friggin' chance today. You know, and I say that with all sincerity. I don't have this thing wired. I don't. Do I have experience? Yes, I have experience. Can I help others? Yes, I can help others. Do I know the book? Yes. But you got to live it. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. And I'm learning how to do that slowly today, but I'm learning how. You know, I get wrapped up in the one thing or I get wrapped up in another, and all of a sudden I see the damage that it's starting to cause, and I go, "Whoa, wait a minute." See, that's a spiritual awakening. Before, I never saw that. I'd pick up a drink. I fixed me with that stuff before anything else. You know, today I got a chance. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has probably been the most significant turn in my life. It's probably the only thing in my life I've done right, other than raising my boy. You know, I love my son to death. We got a special relationship today. He calls me out of nowhere and just tells me he loves me. You know, the first several years of his life, we did a lot of stuff together. Always together. And then when I started drinking again, we grew apart. And now we're growing together again. And Alcoholics Anonymous is a byproduct. They helped me with that. I went to Joe and I said, "Joe, how do we become a better father?" He goes, "Let me tell you how I did it. This is how I do it. You know? How do I make these amends?" They're called living amends. Do the right thing. You know? Don't do the wrong thing. Help your kid when he asks for it. Take off time when it's inconvenient for you to help him. You know, be of service. Even though that your wife has left you, you can still be of service. You don't have to be an ass. Wow. it's taken everything, sometimes more, for me to stay here this time around. The thought of drinking comes and goes once in a while. It doesn't happen a lot. But the thought of not wanting to feel happens every day. I'm still learning how to live in the shell of Glenn. I'm still learning how to live with this thinking on how I think. I'm still treating this alcoholism that I have. You know, it's a one, they say it's a one day at a time program. I didn't know anything about one day at a time at all. I was always, you know, taking it in stride, months and days at a time, and then I'd live in this fear of not accomplishing everything, and then I'd be paralyzed. Today, I have a choice. I can either have willingness to live in faith, or I can be dominated by fear. I don't think I'll ever get rid of fear. I think it will always be there. I think it's my natural instinct to think in the negative every time I project, but I have to slow it down and live in the moment and into the day that it's going to be okay. When I came into this, I've been sober 20 months or so, right in there. My sobriety date is October 1st of 2015. That was my last day that I can say I was sober, you know, to where I didn't have anything from the neck up. On the 31st, I drank one beer earlier that morning, so I couldn't claim that day because I had to cure the hangover from the night before because it was on. And I used to come in and out of here drunk. I'd sit in those chairs drinking. People saw me. They loved me no matter what. It took me 3 years to get 1 year. You guys saw. I sit in those chairs hammered. You know, I wanted it, but I couldn't get it. It's hard to come back, but you can do it. I'm telling you, you can do it. If you're getting back here and you're sitting in that seat and you're wondering what's going to happen next, don't worry about that. You got right now. Right now is the most important minute of your life, man. You know? And if you've been here a while and you're not helping people and you're justifying your behavior, maybe it's time to get right. I don't know. You know, I don't know. I'm just telling you my experience, you know. We get to do this. We get to do this together. And I want to thank all of you for being here tonight and listening to me. Thank you.